on a Monday. It is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers' biennial budget unveiled last month fulfills many Democratic priorities, but it comes with a hefty price tag. Republicans who control the legislature, they're concerned that the $91 billion spending plan puts our state in a financially precarious position. What do you think of the governor's budget? What changes would you like to see Republicans make to the spending plan? What are your spending priorities for our state in light of battling COVID? 800-642-1234 to join in. Representative Mark Bourne is a Republican from Beaver Dam, co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, the legislature's budget writing committee. Representative Bourne, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with common ground on the governor's biennial budget proposal. Since it was presented almost 2 weeks ago, there's been time to dig into it. This is nearly 1,000 pages of bill text. What do you like about it?
Yeah, I think there's certainly some areas of common ground. There's, you know, he is investing in broadband. That's something that we've done the last couple of legislative budgets. There's some investments in healthcare and especially in nursing homes and care for some of our most vulnerable. That was a priority certainly in the last budget for the Republican caucus and the legislature. Now, you know, the devil's always in the details of these budgets, so I'm sure we'll, you know, approach it a little bit differently in some areas or maybe spend a little bit less in some spots, maybe even a little bit more in other areas. But those are certainly, I think, some areas of common interest, and so it should be, you know, fairly similar in our approach. Education is another area, both K-12 and higher education. I think that you know, our caucuses will want to make some investments in those areas. I don't think it'll be at exactly the same level or maybe in exactly the same way or areas, but certainly it was a priority last budget, a major investment in K-12 education. I'm sure there will continue to be focus on that as well.
Well, let's start with education then. The new budget would increase spending on K-12 education by $1.6 billion over the next 2 years. This is more than the governor had proposed in his last budget, which Republicans did reduce. What do you think of his proposed investments in schools?
Yeah, it's certainly important to invest in education, but this amount is way too high. I think you could say that about the budget in general. The budget spends way too much. It taxes way too much. And so we'll have to bring it down to a more realistic investment, living within the state's means, something that families and businesses certainly do without Wisconsin, throughout Wisconsin. And we'll approach the budget in a similar way, but I think you'll certainly see investments and it'll be a priority. I mean, the governor puts more money into K-12 education than even the department asked for. So obviously, it's just another example of excessive spending in his budget.
Representative, the state budget is not just a financial blueprint, a financial roadmap for our state, but it's also a moral compass, right? It reflects the values of our state. What are the values of the Republican Party that will shine through in this next spending plan?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. It's about investing in priorities, and that's been the focus since I've been in the legislature, four budgets now, two on the budget committee, and I don't think this one will be any different. And so I think you'll see us focusing on some of the same things that we have in the past. K-12 education is one. Healthcare is another one, both investments in the healthcare system as well as investments making sure that people have access to health insurance in Wisconsin. We have had good coverage through Wisconsin by using all the tools that are available. And I think you'll see that continue. Also, investments in, as mentioned earlier, you know, our most vulnerable. So whether that be nursing homes or helping with dementia care and things like that, that's been a priority. I think it'll continue to be. And investments in our infrastructure are always a focus too. And so whether that's the broadband that we've already talked about or transportation, things to make sure that we have a good system that supports our economy, the important parts of our economy and commerce, as well as tourism. And I think those are all priorities in Wisconsin, and they have been for some time. Those are the things that when I spend time in the 39th Assembly District talking to my constituents, those are the things they talk to me about. And so that's what we'll focus on.
We're talking with State Representative Mark Bourne. He's co-chair of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. We're talking about drafting the biennial budget and what the legislature has in mind compared to the governor. With your thoughts as well, are you in favor of legalizing marijuana? Should Act 10 be partially rolled back, as Governor Evers has proposed? Are you in favor of the governor's call to increase K-12 funding by $1.6 billion over the next 2 years? It's 800-642-1234. Teresa is with us from Sheboygan. Hi, Teresa.
Good morning. My comment is about marijuana. First of all, it's been scientifically proved it is not a gateway drug. And second, there are over 10 states that have marijuana dispensaries, and they're making millions of dollars for the state. That's used for school upgrades, that's used for infrastructure upgrades. Why are the Republicans refusing to allow this revenue to come into Wisconsin and instead go to surrounding states?
Teresa, thanks. The governor estimates that legalizing marijuana would generate $165 million in tax revenue a year, Representative.
Yeah, and this is kind of a good example of the divisive policy items that are in the budget. And, you know, the problem with putting them in a budget is there are certainly a lot of folks that agree with the caller. You know, and that's one side of the issue. There's certainly a lot of folks on the other side. There's AODA counselors that work with this stuff every day that say that would disagree with the caller and say it's a gateway drug. There's public safety officials that have great concerns about it. There's different studies that point to Colorado, for example, and say the revenue really isn't there that they claim is there. So that's the complexity of these things and why the right place for them is not in the state budget. It should be going through the legislative process, public hearing, where you can hear from stakeholders on both sides, folks like the caller, as well as on the other side of the issue, to kind of, you know, get all the details and information from all sides and make an informed decision rather than hiding it in a 1,800-page document and cramming it in there with a lot of other things that focus on things that aren't related to that at all. So,
but where do you stand on legalizing marijuana for recreational use?
I don't think it should be in the budget at all.
But where do you stand on it? Should Wisconsin legalize recreational marijuana?
I think that it should work its way through the legislative process and folks should have discussions. I've been supportive of medical marijuana in the last session, the bill that was put forward, but I do not support moving forward at this time with recreational marijuana.
Let's look more closely at taxes. The governor has proposed cutting some taxes, raising others. How he would limit tax credits available to some manufacturers, increase capital gains taxes on high-income people. How likely is it that these will be approved by the legislature?
I don't think this is a good time at all to be increasing taxes. I don't generally think most of the time is a good time, but certainly now as we're coming through, you know, a national pandemic, it looks like we're hopefully coming to the end of it as the numbers are getting a lot better and the vaccine is more available. But we've got a lot of businesses and families that have struggled through the last year financially, and I don't think the best way to get our economy and our communities and our businesses back on their feet is to do a bunch of massive tax increases, especially focused on our manufacturing, which is one of the core parts of our economy here in Wisconsin. I just don't see how that would be a good policy thing at this time. And it's also not necessary. You know, we have put ourselves in a strong financial situation as a state with sound budgeting this last few cycles that have put us in a place where we have a general fund surplus and we have the largest rainy day fund in state history and we have good revenue projections moving forward into this next budget. So we have funds available to invest in priorities. So there isn't any reason to be going for massive tax increases on the families of Wisconsin at this time.
Representative Mark Bourne of Beaver Dam, new co-chair of the State Budget Writing Committee. How would you like to see state lawmakers address the pandemic in the next two-year spending plan? What parts of the governor's budget proposal do you want lawmakers to write into their own version? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute. More State Cap here on the Ideas Network. here with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with Representative Mark Bourne of Beaver Dam. In December, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss installed Bourne as co-chair of the state's Budget Writing Committee. He presides alongside State Senator Howard Markline of Spring Green. The Assembly and Senate are now writing their own version of the two-year budget following the governor's proposal last month. Finalized budget, it's due July 1. What does responsible budgeting mean to you? What are your values and priorities for the budget? 800-642-1234. And Representative Bourne stays with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Nate now in Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Sure.
I was going to say that I'm glad second look is being taken at Act 10 and that it'll be yanked. And I say that because I support the idea of people having freedom. The certification elections in Act 10 are basically rigged against workers having the ability to choose to have a union, because frequently the people voting to keep their union, the votes are more than to get rid of the union, yet the union is decertified anyway. And the other part of Act 10 is that it basically takes away what the workers can ask for through their union. And we've got this pandemic, which I hope will be dealt with this year after everyone's vaccinated. But that goes to show that workplace conditions can be a very valuable thing. And Act 10 prevents workers from being able to discuss their workplace conditions through their unions.
Yeah, Nate, thank you for bringing that up, the partial rollback of Act 10 in this budget. Representative, your thoughts?
Yeah, another example of a policy item that has no place in this budget, as well as the fact that, you know, really this is, you know, 10-year-old established law now. There are municipal budgets throughout the state that are operating under this current law, and this type of rollback would leave billions of dollars of holes in those budgets. So it's certainly not a good public policy approach at this point either.
What about the minimum wage? The governor has proposed gradually raising the state's minimum wage until it gets to $10.15 on January 1st, 2024. He's created a task force to look at how to reach $15 an hour. The state's current minimum wage of $7.25 was set in 2009. Is it time for an increase?
I think it's unlikely that that'll stay in this budget. I think that if you look at, around our state right now, certainly as I look around the district, there are a lot of jobs available, and none of them are posted at minimum wage. We've got a really strong economy here in the state and a lot of jobs throughout the sectors available, and I don't think that minimum wage will be a focus in this budget.
Should the minimum wage be increased in Wisconsin?
I don't think that that's something we'll be focused on this budget.
Anthony called from Manitowoc, couldn't stay with us, and he heard you say the governor allocated too much for K-12 education in this budget. And Anthony wants to know how much money is, you know, should be provided to education. What is your dollar amount that you're looking at?
Sure, yeah, and that's a good question. That's certainly part of what the budget process is. As we move through the next few months, you know, we will look at all the funds available. As I said, we're in a good financial position with surpluses, and then we will decide how to split up amongst those priorities that we've talked about. And, you know, part of what we will look at in K-12 education is the historic large investments we've made in the last two budgets. We'll take a look at all the federal funding that's been coming in through the CARES Act during the pandemic. There has been significant federal investments made, and we'll have to take a look at how that impacts school budgets and figure out how that impacts our decisions then on the total state investment. So it's too early to say the exact amount, but I'm confident that, you know, people in the legislature, because of what we hear in our districts, will invest in K-12 education.
Do you support getting back to 2/3 funding formula to cover school costs?
I think that's a good goal. It's something certainly that we've worked on in the past, and we're fairly close last time. So I think we'll take a look at that again to see if, that's something that works in the mix. But I think it's a good goal to work towards, certainly.
You know, Republicans who control the Assembly and Senate have disagreed on a COVID relief bill in the past recent history here. Are Republican lawmakers on the same page when it comes to budget priorities for the next spending plan?
I think so. I mean, we've early in our discussions, and obviously there will be disagreements from time to time on certain issues and things. There have been the last two budgets that I've been part of the budget committee, and I'm sure this will be no different. It's a massive document. It has a lot of different priorities and parts of state government and things that impact the state in different ways. And so even people that are generally like-minded can certainly find places of difference in it. But that's all part of the process that we'll work through in the budget process. And I think that you've seen here in certainly recent weeks agreement on the COVID package, agreement on the UI bill. And so I think that, we're working together, working on things that are important for the state, and that's what will be the focus in the budget.
UI, unemployment insurance.
Yes.
Yeah. We're talking with State Representative Mark Bourne, co-chair of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. And as we look at the future of the next biennial budget for 2021 to 2023, a finalized budget is due July 1. Taking your insights as well, your questions about the budget writing process at 800-642-1234. Lori is joining us from Shawano this morning. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
Hi. Your guest said that he's against legalizing recreational marijuana, but what is the issue that the Republicans have with medical marijuana? If people are in pain and sick, why should they be denied that? And the other issue I have with your guest is with the wealthy, he doesn't want to raise taxes on them, but it was okay 10 years ago with this Act 10 to take benefits away from public employees, including teachers. So why attack so many people who are maybe middle class, but it's not okay to tax these people who are very wealthy?
Lori, thanks. Representative Bourne.
Yeah, I think in the case of Act 10, you're talking about a budget repair bill that was done in a time when the state was in a $3 billion deficit, versus a time where we have, like I said, $1.8 billion in a surplus in the general fund. The rainy day fund is about $1 billion, the largest in state history. We're showing strong economic growth coming out of this pandemic. So we're not in a giant hole where tough budget decisions like that have to be made. And so that's, I think, a huge difference. And, that's just the reality of the situation that we're in. As far as the medical marijuana, I think that has had bipartisan interest in the past. I think it will be continuing to be discussed, and I think it's just one of those things that is a major reform and still involves a drug that is scheduled as an illegal drug on the federal level. And so there are ways that you have to work through that process when you're trying to legalize those sorts of things in states, and some states have moved faster than others, and Wisconsin is working through that process.
You're new to the chairmanship of Joint Finance. How do you want to make your mark?
I think I just want to focus on doing the stuff that I've been doing on the committee in the last two cycles, and help lead our caucus and represent the folks in my district and throughout Wisconsin in making sure that we're investing in the priorities for this state and keeping the state strong and moving forward. And that'll be our focus in this next budget.
Do you think we'll see a finalized budget by July 1st?
I think so. I certainly hope so. We're certainly on schedule at this point, so we'll keep plugging along here for the next few months, and that'll be the goal.
When you say we're on schedule and plugging along, very quickly here, can you tell us about the process that the budget will go through in the coming weeks and months?
Yeah, right now for the next few weeks, we'll be reviewing the budget document. Our fiscal bureau will be doing their analysis to make sure that we understand in great detail everything that the governor has is asking to do in the executive budget. We'll get out in April and on the roadshow, as they call it, we'll tour the state and have some public hearings. We'll also have some virtual and other options for folks to interact with the committee if they don't want to join us at a public hearing. And then we'll start our executive session to start crafting the legislative budget probably in May and through the bunch of June to get it to the governor by July 1 is the goal.
Representative Bourne, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Bourne represents District 39 in the Assembly. He's a Republican from Beaver Dam. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with a focus on families. We check in with the Secretary of the Department of Children and Families, Emily Amundson. There's more State Cap. Stay with us. News update is next on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're zooming in on issues hitting families in this pandemic and what the next 2 years state budget could mean for the agency that's responsible for providing services to assist children and families. One overriding issue here, child care costs. They're high, unaffordable for many families. The child care crisis has only worsened in the pandemic. Share your family situation with child care and other issues. How is our state doing in protecting the most vulnerable children? Are you going through an adoption or are you a foster parent? What would you like to share? Join in at 800-642-1234. Emily Amundson is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. Secretary Amundson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's nice to be back.
Well, before we dig into the governor's budget, what kind of stress is the pandemic putting on Wisconsin's child welfare system and families in our state?
Sure. Yeah, I think that this has just been, obviously an unprecedented year, coming up on a year. And I think that we have all learned so much about how to combat toxic stress, how to work within this new normal that we're all experiencing. And, it feels like it was about a year when we were all starting to process the pandemic and the effect that the pandemic was having on our child welfare system. So recall about a year ago when schools went virtual, on a moment's notice, we were really grappling with a very significant decline in the number of reports that were coming in. And the good news is that I think as we've adjusted to our new normal, we've really seen the system sort of respond appropriately. So right now, we really see a system that is continuing to sort of see a downward trend in the number of overall reports, but also in the number of kids that are removed from their homes and the number of kids that are in out of home care. I think that there's different ways to look at that. And certainly what we're seeing in child welfare agencies across our state is with that decline in the number of reports, we're also seeing an ability to work these cases and really put the time and the care into the cases in a way that I think is having a significant impact on families in need.
And when you say a decline in the number of reports, you're talking about potential cases of child abuse?
I am. Yes, we've seen and it's just a slight dip. And so really about this time last year, we're almost on par for what we would see in a normal year. And that's it, again, in my mind, that's the system learning how to respond to a new normal. Usually our mandated reporters of law enforcement and educators provide the vast majority, almost 50% of our referrals for child abuse and neglect. Now, about half of those referrals, little more than half of those referrals are screened out. But we're seeing those same two groups really, responding the way that they would normally respond. And so it's sort of a testament to how the system does learn how to respond to a new normal.
You know, we had talked about how caseworkers had to adjust how they meet with children and families. How has that been in the winter months? Because before you were trying to meet outside or, you know, between the glass and the door. How is that going?
Yeah, well, we've gotten very creative over the last year. And I think what we've learned is that there are some things that can be appropriately done using virtual technology. And so some of the check-in, some of the sort of weekly meetings and things like that can be appropriately done over the virtual technologies that we've all become conversant in. I think that you're right. There were a lot more outside meetings. I know I heard of caseworkers getting very creative in terms of, you know, coming up and talking through screen doors and things like that. But at a certain point, we also grappled with the reality that caseworkers needed to be able to see their kids and families. And that is why we advocated so strongly that our child welfare workers needed to be included in that first vaccination wave, and they were. And so what we're seeing across our states is more and more of our child welfare workers are fully vaccinated and are able to carry on and feel confident about when they need to go in and meet with a family in the home, that they can do that.
The governor wants to increase funding by $15 million over the two-year budget to help counties handle child welfare cases. Why is more funding needed?
Oh, boy. Well, this is just a huge budget for kids and families when it comes to making some changes to the child welfare system that are really guiding us in that national direction. And so there's a piece of federal legislation called Families First. And this is really a shift, kind of a historic shift in the child welfare system that really tries to keep kids with their family whenever possible. If that's not possible, we need to keep them in the community whenever possible. We know that kids need their family. Kids need to be feeling safe and secure with folks that they know. And so that focus on prevention means that we need to create a whole lot more supports around families that may be experiencing vulnerability, families that may need extra help. And that takes a lot more sort of hands-on casework. That takes a lot more support, a lot more evidence-based practice. And so this potential increase, coupled with some of the other proposals, is really about making sure that our child welfare workforce across the state has the adequate caseload that they need, has the number of staff that they need to truly provide these families the supports and the safety services and the prevention services that families need to be able to keep their children at home whenever possible.
In the pandemic, have you struggled with caseloads for staff, for caseworkers, or is it a manageable load?
Well, you know, it's been interesting because obviously we are on the heels of a historic increase in CFA, and that was really CFA aid, children and families aid, and that was really a successful, you know, budget campaign 2 years ago to say caseloads have ballooned as a result, primarily because of the opiate and methamphetamine epidemic in the state. We were seeing all-time high, you know, caseloads and number of kids in out-of-home care. And so that investment really got us started on a path of trying to, you know, hire more workforce, trying to reduce those caseloads. And then, of course, you know, over the last year, what we've been able to see is because of the reduction in the number of referrals, you know, this slight downtick in the number of referrals, particularly at the beginning of the pandemic, I would say that caseloads started to kind of even out a little bit. And folks are experiencing the benefit that comes with that, you know, the additional time and energy that they can apply to these more complex cases. Because frankly, what we're seeing during the pandemic, we're not necessarily seeing a reduction in the number of complex cases. So when you do get a screened in case, chances are it may be a little bit more complex and it may be a little bit more time intensive for that caseworker.
We're discussing the governor's state budget proposal with Emily Amundson, Secretary of the State Department of Children and Families. What questions do you have for the head of DCF? What would you like to share? What policy or program do you think would benefit the state's children and families, especially the most vulnerable children? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. I want to look at opioids here for a second, and you had mentioned there that the growing caseloads in the past perhaps had to do with abuse of opioids and methamphetamine. Is substance abuse still a growing factor in child welfare referrals and placements?
Oh, undeniably so, yes. And I think that when we look across this budget, I mean, obviously there's been a ton of work that's been done over the last few years, both legislatively and across a number of state agency budgets to, you know, to stabilize this trend that we're seeing. I think the pandemic has exacerbated a lot of those substance abuse issues for families. I think what I'm excited about when I look across the breadth of the governor's budget, you know, you look at the Department of Health Services budget, and you look at some of the investments that they are proposing to make in substance use and abuse, crisis stabilization services for adults. And I think about how, and then obviously Medicaid expansion and what that would bring to, you know, the overall milieu of services that we could offer adults. And then you look at the children and families budget, and you look at just this shift that we're trying to undertake in focusing on the family. So rather than always looking at the child and saying, what does the child need to be safe in home? We start to think about, like, how do we support the family in making sure that the family is a place where all members of the family are safe at home? So, you know, things like in-home, you know, safety supports, home visiting programs, some of the work that we've done, you know, across the agencies during the pandemic around rental assistance and heating assistance. These are all things that help.
So looking more holistically at what the family needs. Yeah. We have DCF Secretary Emily Amundson with us. Parents, what support would you like more of from state government to help children the most? Is your family working with a caseworker? How has that been in the pandemic? How is your child doing? 800-642-1234. Still time to talk. Back in a minute with Secretary Amundson here on the Ideas Network. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Emily Amundson, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. The need for foster families continues to grow. The foster care coordinator for Eau Claire County told the student news site of UW-Eau Claire in December that recruiting foster families has become more difficult for social workers during the pandemic. Are you a caseworker or a foster parent? What can you tell us about these times and caring for vulnerable kids? What should the state do to step up with more budget to help children and families? 800-642-1234. DCF Secretary Emily Amundson is with us for 10 more minutes. Secretary, let's look closer here at foster families. Payments to foster care providers would rise 2.5% in 2022 and again by that amount in 2023 under the governor's proposal. Why do foster care providers need more money?
Oh, boy. Well, this is really in line with that shift that we're trying to make to the whole system, right, around family first and making sure that children who do have to be removed for their home for a short period of time or a longer period of time, that they are in the most home-like setting possible. And that's really a huge shift for the system to make. So we're recognizing that home-like setting is absolutely critical and critically important. That's what kids know. That's where they're coming from. And so this idea of foster care, every level of foster care, being so important to making that shift in the system. And we need to make sure that those rates keep up with the rising costs of, of all of the elements of raising and taking care of kids. I think the other piece that I want to highlight here is the kinship care rate increase. So that's a rate increase for relative caregivers. And again, that's critically important to the philosophy of making the shift in our system. We're saying, kids do better if they do have to be removed from their home for a short period of time or a longer period of time. Kids do better when they're with folks they know, when they're with their kin. And this rate has been historically kept much lower than the foster care rate. And this budget would seek to change that. I think really investing in family find resources and making sure that if there are available caregivers out there that are relatives, that we're able to find them and we're able to resource them appropriately so that kids can be with family whenever possible.
Whether it is the kinship rate or the foster care provider rate, how much do the state's payments typically cover the costs, the actual costs of caring for children?
Well, that really varies across the state. We know it's frankly, never enough. And yet we do have a tiered system. And that's one thing that I'd like to highlight is that when we talk about the need for more foster families in our state, what we really are desperately in need of are those higher level continuum of care foster placements. And so we call them treatment foster care. And usually these are folks who step up and they say, we have specialized training to help, deal with kids who have experienced trauma or kids who need additional mental health supports. And so in a lot of communities across the state, it can feel really frustrating because counties will say, we have an appropriate number of foster care families in our pool, but we may not have the right matches in terms of the level of care needed for a particular kiddo. And so that's really something that we need to work on across our state. And again, I think that these increases will help, but it's also just frankly, it's a calling and it's a labor of love. And I think that we have to continue to treat it as such. I know communities that have really invested in making sure that there are cohorts of support for foster care families, making sure that they have people they can turn to for respite care when they need a break from doing this important work in communities. Folks that have invested in that way have seen a strong foster care cadre stay in their community. And so I think working with counties to really make sure that they have the supports that they need to be able to support their foster community is vitally important moving forward under Family First.
So it sounds like you can't really make a blanket statement that there is a shortage of foster care providers because it might look very different from one county to the next.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I think that can sometimes add to the frustration that folks feel when they've invested the time and energy and resources to become a licensed foster family, and they're saying, nobody's calling, or we're not getting, we're not being tapped. Sometimes it's because of that mismatch in that level of care that, again, these kids that we're seeing in care right now often come with more complex care needs, and that's why building this milieu of services in our state to help care for the kids that we have in care right now is really important.
We're discussing the state budget proposals with Emily Amundson, Secretary of the State Department of Children and Families. What's been your experience with our state's foster care system or with child welfare services? What is communication like these days with your caseworker? What could be improved? What insights do you have? 800-642-1234 to join in. Let's look at a big area of struggle, child care. Governor Evers' budget seeks to expand access to affordable child care with $53 million in annual state funding for providers with these extra incentives for infant and toddler care. What is the state access? What is the concern here, and what are you trying to address through this budget?
Sure. So this is just an absolutely historic investment in child care. As folks know, usually child care is treated, sort of like a private business. It's really looked at very differently than the K-12 system in terms of, the private business angle, and then obviously the parents' ability to either seek and afford child care or not. Mm. And I think what we're seeing here is that across our state, if we don't have accessible, high-quality, affordable child care, we see what happens. And I think the pandemic has laid that bare. When child care closes, the economy really, really suffers as a result. We've seen just an absolutely massive bleed of females from the workforce as a result of child care access being pinched through the pandemic. And I think we need to reconcile with the fact that without some state support braided into the system, we are not going to have a viable child care system moving forward. And that's particularly important for infants and toddlers. There are so many fewer spots for infants in particular than there are folks that need that care. So this is really a recognition that childcare is a backbone to local economies, and without increasing state support, we're going to lose that resource from communities, particularly rural communities. Over 50% of rural communities are deemed childcare deserts, which means there just aren't enough spots for the families that need them. We've got to change that.
Under the budget proposal, workers could use family and medical leave if a school or a child care provider closes unexpectedly. Why do you support that change?
Well, I think that anyone who has worked over the last year with colleagues who have felt that, that stressful moment of being told, our classroom is closing for 2 weeks. This just happened to my brother's family. Sunday night you get an email, and Monday you have childcare issue that lasts for 2 weeks long. That's the kind of support that we need to give to families in the midst of a pandemic where schools and childcare centers have to open and close at a moment's notice to keep our kids safe. That's an incredibly important provision.
Secretary Amundson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. Appreciate it.
Emily Amundson is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. Earlier, we talked with State Representative Mark Bourne of Beaver Dam. Just ahead, it's an hour-long conversation about end-of-life planning. A lawyer joins us to discuss wills, estates, trusts, your questions. This is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.